working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. The following is a... This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
And a reminder that this is an archived interview on the Afternoon Magazine, recorded earlier, so we won't be able to take phone calls today. Celeste Quinn returns to the program next week again. We invite you to enjoy this archived interview, and we'll be taking phone calls again as the program continues live next week.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. She says her father had a great impact on her, and she owes him much. On the program today, we'll talk about that father, Orson Welles, with that daughter, Chris Welles Fader. Chris Welles Fader has written a memoir about her childhood and coming of age and her famous father, the title In My Father's Shadow, A Daughter Remembers Orson Welles. Chris, short for Christopher, Welles was born to Orson Welles and his first wife, Virginia Nicholson. Chris was Welles' firstborn, one of three daughters he had with three wives. It is clear from In My Father's Shadow that Chris adored her father, sought his attention, and wanted his approval. Given the pressures of the film business and Welles' artistic drive, that was often a tall order. There were long periods of time when he was absorbed by work. There were long periods of time when he was altogether absent. In the book, Chris tells of an occasion when she patiently watched her father as he worked. She says she watched him slashing through pages with a furious pencil, smiling at other pages. She thought, if I sit here long enough, he'll look up and notice me. Sure enough, he did. She says, I never felt more intelligent, more sure of myself than when I was alone with my father and had his full attention. Then I could tell him anything, and he listened, not as one listens to a child, but as though he were hearing a younger version of himself. This was heady stuff, and to have such moments with my father made me hunger for more. That is from the book In My Father's Shadow. Chris Welles Fader has spent a good portion of her life in the field of education. She's a writer for the children's education series Brain Quest, published by Workman Publishing. In My Father's Shadow, A Daughter Remembers Orson Welles, is published by Algonquin Books. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Chris Welles Fader, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for the lovely introduction.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It is such a pleasure to speak with you. It was a delight reading this book and gaining a new understanding of the man Orson Welles.
Oh, that makes me very happy to hear, because I was hoping that my book would give people a fresh look at him.
Yeah. I was moved by that passage where you write of sitting very still as a girl and waiting for your father to turn your way. He listened to you, you say, not as one listens to a child, but as though he were hearing a younger version of himself. How did that insight come to you?
I think that insight probably came to me in later years, looking back and recollecting the scene. I think as a child, I was just eager for his attention. I wasn't at that age really capable of realizing exactly what was going on.
Yeah. A younger version of himself, I think that's very interesting. What had your father been like as a child? What was his childhood like?
I wish I knew more about his childhood because he was orphaned at a very early age, and so I was never able to meet his parents, and I only know them indirectly through Hortense and Roger Hill, who became his like his foster parents after his own parents died. But I would have, from what I've heard, it sounded as though my father had a childhood where his mother focused very heavily on teaching him music, reading poetry to him, encouraging him to memorize poems and put on puppet plays. She fostered, I think, his creative drive.
So does that give us an understanding of what pulled him toward radio and later film?
Well, I guess I don't know if we can. Certainly his mother, I think, in many ways was his creative inspiration, and she died when he was 9 years old. I think he just happened to be at the in the right time at the right place as far as radio was concerned, because he was in New York as a young actor looking for work, and radio was in its golden heyday at that time, and he had the ability to imitate all kinds of different voices, and that's really what gave him his start, was radio.
Mm. You open the book with the story of your father's funeral, and the man who thought of your father as a stepson was there, Roger Skipper Hill. From this first account of him, Roger Hill, I liked him immediately. Tell us about Roger Hill and his wife, Hortense.
They ran a school for boys in Woodstock, Illinois, Todd School for Boys, that my father attended when he was, I think, 11 years old. And which I also attended at approximately the same age, maybe a little younger. I think I was 10. And they were just a wonderful couple. I think Skipper was definitely, he used to scoff and say, oh, I really wasn't your father's mentor because your father already knew everything he needed to know about the theater, which was his passion as a young boy. But I think Skipper was very important to my father because he encouraged him to explore his creativity and his theatrical ambitions. And he allowed my father to put on a great many plays at Todd School while he was still a schoolboy. And he was he remained a fast friend for as long as he lived.
And what was your experience like at the Todd School?
My mother sent me to Todd School when she was between marriages, and the main reason she sent me there was to be with the Hills, who were like my honorary grandparents. Being the only girl in a boys' school was, was a little difficult, particularly in the beginning. The little boys in my class weren't very happy to have a girl in their midst. But they did slowly come around, and eventually they were very sweet to me. And I was only there for a couple of years. Yeah. But as I said, the main thing for me was living with Granny and Skipper Hill, as I called them, because they were just so good to me.
Yeah. You describe Hortense as being a more loving mother than your own. You also say that as a young woman, you believed your mother really did care about you, Virginia Nicholson, your mother. When your father died, she reached out to you. As an adult, did the two of you have a good or better relationship?
I think eventually, towards the end of my mother's life, I made a very great effort to reach out to her and to bring about a reconciliation. But for much of our life together, we had a troubled relationship, and I would say, especially in my childhood, she was a very difficult parent, and I was just fortunate that I had other people who were more than happy to take care of me during that time, such as Granny Hill.
And Marie,
my nanny Marie, and others, my maternal grandparents, and I had a very loving aunt, my mother's sister. So I was blessed in that sense that I had other people who stepped forward and took care of me.
Yeah. I also feel that you were quite fond of your mother's second husband.
Oh, yes. I was very, very fond of him. Charlie Lederer, who was in his day quite a well-known screenwriter, and he was a delight. Mm. And he was also a very close friend of my father's, so that helped enormously because when we all lived in Hollywood, Charlie, my father, was welcome at our house, and he was in and out of our house all the time.
I think you had a strong sense of who you were when you were a child. Is that true?
It's kind of hard for me to know that, whether I did or not, but I guess since I somehow managed to survive my unorthodox childhood, I guess I must have had some strength somewhere, you know, to deal with everything that was going on in my life at that time.
That's such a good way to look at it, unorthodox.
Well, it was not the most conventional upbringing.
No, and it had its ups as well as its downs.
Oh, definitely it did. Yeah. And I had I think I inherited from my father a very sunny nature, a sort of upbeat, optimistic nature. And I think that also helped me a lot in those early years.
Yeah. What led you to begin writing this book?
After my father died in 1985, I was trying to put together and make sense of my whole relationship with him, the enormous impact that he had had on me and the degree of influence that he had on me, but also there were more troubling aspects to our relationship as well, his prolonged absences, which you alluded to in your introduction, and the fact that I couldn't always be with him and so on. And I was trying to make sense of all this, and I began writing what eventually became a book of poems, which I called The Movie Director, and which I never really intended to publish. It was just a private work, a way of working things out for myself. But then I decided that I really needed to go public with my vision of my father and what he meant to me and the way I saw him, particularly when I read all these other books about him, which were written by people who never really knew him or got closer to him than a long-distance phone call. And I felt that, after all, I knew him pretty well, as much as anybody could know him. He was kind of enigmatic in a way, but certainly I had known him in my childhood and until he died. And so I wanted to put that picture out there. But I also, I think, wanted to write about my relationship with him and how eventually I did come out of his shadow and make my own way in the world. And I'd hoped that that story would be uplifting to other people.
Yeah. What insights did you gain into how children manage to emerge or not from their parents' shadows?
I think it's very important, even as a child, to have passionate interests, things that keep you going, that engage you, because then if you have something you really love to do, whatever it might be, it could just be roller skating, you know, but something you really love to do, then I think it keeps you going and it helps you deal with the more troubling aspects of a difficult childhood. So that, I think, is important in early childhood. And also connections, having friends. I think my friends helped me over many, many rough spots when I was young. And that they can be contemporary friends or they can be adult friends. But having those strong personal connections, passionate interests, and eventually finding something you love to do, which eventually becomes your work.
Mm.
I mean, to me, these are my best survival tools.
Mm. One of the passions you had as a child, as a girl, was the ocean.
Yes.
Do you still love the ocean?
I love the ocean. My dream would be to eventually live by the ocean.
Mm. Do you think you could have made a career in a field that took you to and into the world's oceans?
Well, I think much as I love the ocean, I had a much deeper passion, which was music, and also writing. I love to write. Even as a little child, I would love to write stories and illustrate them and give them to the grown-ups in my world for Christmas presents. And I had seriously considered becoming a musician, but then I veered off into the direction of writing instead. But I would say that was, from a very early age, those were the things that engaged me.
Now, I mentioned that you have been a writer for the children's series Brain Quest. I'm wondering if you've thought of, or maybe you have done this, written books for children that were not educational tools, that were like the kind of stories that you wrote as a girl.
Actually, most of my writing for children has been in the field of education. I did many school books for kids, textbooks. I worked for Scott Forsman in Chicago for a number of years doing textbooks for them. And then I was actually the author of the original Brain Quest games, which are based on the school curriculum for children from kindergarten up through 7th grade. So actually all my writing for children has been in the field of education, and I haven't really considered writing trade books for children. I think I'm more interested in writing poetry for adults or nonfiction.
I'm wondering if you could bring back to life a story that you wrote as a girl. I think that might be rather interesting.
I don't know if those stories are good enough. I think the things that we do as children, you know, they can be fun and charming, but I don't honestly know if they would, if those early stories that I did as a child would have interest to anyone except the people for whom they were originally written.
Yeah. Will the book of poetry be published?
Well, at the moment, I'm working on a collection of poetry. Mm. It's impossible to get poetry published. I don't honestly know if it ever will be. The movie director was something that I wasn't able to publish and finally had to publish privately at my husband's urging. I would just love it if somebody would pick up the movie director and publish it with a small press. That would be a dream come true.
Yeah. Algonquin, maybe?
Well, that would be nice. I guess it will depend on... Algonquin does publish poetry, but mostly I think they publish fiction and nonfiction, and a lot will depend on how well my current book does with them in My Father's Shadow. If that does well, perhaps they might consider publishing the movie director. But, you know, unfortunately, there's such a limited audience for poetry. It is unfortunate, but that's the way it is right now.
Yeah. Was Algonquin pleased with In My Father's Shadow, pleased to publish it?
Oh, they were very pleased. In fact, my editor, I have a wonderful editor there, Chuck Adams, and he told me recently that that he's very proud of this book.
I think you should be proud of it as well.
Well, I have been really gratified by the reviews that the book has gotten. It's had such an overwhelmingly positive response, and you never know when you publish a book how it will be received, and I've really been very pleased with the reviews.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Chris Wells Fader. She is the author of the memoir In My Father's Shadow, A Daughter Remembers Orson Welles. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with a phone call. I look forward to hearing from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, Chris is short for Christopher.
That's right.
How did your father decide that you should be named Christopher?
This was decided before I was born. He loved the name Christopher, and he thought that the combination of Christopher Wells, that those two names, that struck the right musical note for him. Well, when I turned out to be a girl, they decided, well, so much the better, because there are no little girls named Christopher. And if you know anything about my father, Orson Welles, you know that he always liked to do the unusual thing. So he was very pleased to name his daughter Christopher.
Mm. I could, in my imagination, I can hear him calling you that.
And he always did. He always called me Christopher.
Christopher. Did your mother like the name?
I think she did, too, obviously, since she agreed with him to name me Christopher. I was the only one who was unhappy with my name as a little girl because I was, as you can imagine, I was teased mercilessly since at that time it was very unusual to give a girl a boy's name. Now it's much more common.
Yeah.
But I remember one day coming home in tears and saying to my mother, oh, everyone is teasing me. I hate my name. I want to change my name to Linda. Because at that time, my best friend was called Linda, and nobody was teasing her, and I thought that was a lovely name. So my mother, who is a smart lady, she said, all right, very good. Well, then we're going to draw up a document that will allow you to change your name when you're 21. So she sat down, those were the days of typewriters, and she typed up this very impressive-looking document, and then everybody in the house, who was in the house at the time, signed it, my stepfather and my nanny and whoever else was around. Then she rolled it up and tied it with a ribbon and gave it to me and said, now, you take that to school and you show that to all those nasty little children. And you tell them that you're permitted to change your name when you're 21. Well, of course, she was very smart. She knew that by the time I was 21, I'd be very happy with my name, which I was.
Yeah, yeah. It's a terrific name. Your father was right on, Christopher Wells. It's a great name.
But I did shorten it eventually to
Chris.
Only because it was confusing.
Right.
So now my name is Chris Wellsfader on all my documents, and I still get a mail address to Mr. Chris Wellsfader. But most people who meet me, they assume that Chris is short for Christina or something.
Mm-hmm. One of the funny stories in the book, I think, is from a time when you and your mom and her second husband were living in Santa Monica, and your father was a frequent visitor. He frequently visited your mother and her husband and you, and he came one time, and wanting to impress him, to get his attention, you asked him, shall I make you a martini?
That's right, yes. I know. I was taught to make, my mother taught me to make martinis when I was very young, because one of the customs in Hollywood in those days was that, you know, everybody would gather on the porch to watch the sunset and drink their martinis. And my mother thought it was very cute to have her little girl, you know, mix the martinis and then offer them around to the adults. And, of course, my father was horrified at this idea. You know, he didn't think it was funny at all.
Yeah.
He thought it was absolutely the wrong thing to teach me how to do. But actually, I really did make a mean martini.
Well, wasn't it your stepfather, Charlie Lederer, who said to Orson Welles, it'll put hair on your teeth?
Yes, I really made a terrific martini. I, of course, have never been able to drink them myself. I find them much too strong. But I did. I was well taught. And if ever you want a really good martini, I'd be happy to make you one.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about Charlie Lederer and his famous aunt.
His famous aunt, who was Marion Davies, who was a film star, as you know, and also the mistress of William Randolph Hearst, the press baron, who believed that Citizen Kane was about him. My father always maintained that it wasn't, but anyway, who knows? Certainly there is much of Hearst is in that movie. And I think what he was particularly offended by was the portrait of the actress who plays the character of Marion Davies and portrays her as an alcoholic. And that, I think, offended him much more than his own character in the movie.
Mm.
But in any case, Charlie was an absolutely delightful. He had a sense of humor, which a kind of screwball sense of humor, and of course he was known as a writer of screwball comedies. You may know the movie My Gal Friday with Rosalind Russell and Clark Gable. I mean, sorry, not Clark Gable. Anyway, you know the movie I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Charlie wrote the script for that, and that's a good example of his humor. And he was just a lot of fun to be around.
And what was it like visiting San Simeon with him and your mom?
Well, I always found it a little spooky because my mother and Marion Davies and Charlie all felt that if Hearst saw too much of me, he would get apoplexy because I was the child of Orson Welles who had made that dreadful movie Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And so they conspired to keep me out of sight so that I wouldn't upset Mr. Hearst. So my experience of San Simeon was being spirited away and kept far away from the adults and sleeping in the tower with my nanny, you know, feeling sort of like a prisoner in a fairy tale or something. So I don't really have many happy memories of San Simeon because of that situation.
But once again, once you're an adult, you can look back on it and go, that was something.
Well, as an adult, I look back on it and I remember what a staggeringly beautiful and opulent place it was. Not at all the gloomy picture that you get in Citizen Kane. The Xanadu is a very gloomy mansion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas San Simeon was a place of light-filled rooms and luxury and wide-open spaces and beautiful grounds and spectacular swimming pools. You know, it was really quite something.
Citizen Kane is seen by so many people as being the best or one of the best films ever made. What do you think of it?
I just remember being so blown away. The first time I saw Citizen Kane, I saw it in Chicago when I was in my late teens, and I had never realized that a movie could be a work of art until I saw Citizen Kane, and it was just a total revelation to me.
Yeah, and also to the man who's now your husband.
And it's interesting that my husband, Erwin Feder, he saw Citizen Kane about the same age that I did, although, of course, he was growing up in New York and we didn't know each other at that time. And he had the same reaction, of realizing that he was seeing a work of art.
What other works of your father's do you think stand out? And why is it we don't see more of his work in addition to Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons?
Well, that's such a good question. I wish we did see more of his films. I think one of them that stands out is Chimes at Midnight, which has also been called Falstaff, and that's a movie that he made in Europe. He cobbled together several of the Shakespearean Henry plays in which Falstaff is the main character. And he plays Falstaff. I think it's one of his great movie roles. And it's an outstanding film. And it's interestingly enough, he considered it his masterpiece. He once said to me, if I were to get to heaven on the basis of one film, Chimes at Midnight is the one I would offer up.
Hmm.
And I think the reason it's not shown more often in this country, I don't quite understand it, but it's been tied up in all kinds of litigation. I think it's had almost too many owners and people fighting over it, and this is one reason why it hasn't been shown more often. But other of his films, I wish, like The Trial, he made a movie of Kafka's The Trial, which I think with Anthony Perkins,
mm-hmm.
which is also very fine. And he did an essay film. He kind of invented a new sort of movie. It's not really a documentary. It's what he called an essay film. It's like personal opinions and digressions on the theme. And then the theme of this particular film, which is called F for Fake, is truth and fakery in art. And it's a fascinating work, and I believe that that's now available on DVD in this country. So I'm hoping that one of the things my book will do is acquaint the general public with the amazing films that he made in Europe, which are not shown as often as they should be in this country, some of which are now available on DVD, and that this will encourage people to educate themselves more about not just the films that we see all the time, Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons and Touch of Evil and Lady from Shanghai, but, you know, the six films that he made in Europe, which really rounded out his work.
Yeah. I'm very much interested in seeing Afer Fakhri. I remember seeing The Trial when I was about the age you first saw Citizen Kane, and I had read, not long before, Kafka's story, novel, The Trial, and I thought that the film was so remarkable in capturing what
Kafka had done. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant film, and I think Anthony Perkins gives the performance of his life in that film.
I think you're right.
And I really wish that was shown more often. But you see, I think one of the problems, it's interesting that my father is so revered in Europe. But in Europe, there's more of a tradition for art films. Whereas in our country, we all grew up with Hollywood and with the idea that movies should be entertainment. And so art film doesn't have quite the following here, I don't think.
Yeah. Also, it seems that for many people today, black and white is an issue.
Yes, they want it in color.
Yeah.
You know, Ted Turner tried to colorize Citizen Kane.
Oh.
What a relief that he didn't succeed.
Yeah. I saw some of those colorized films.
Oh.
They're just so bad.
The color is so muddy. Yeah. But, you know, it's true that my father loved to work in black and white because you get these great effects, these dramatic effects with light and shadow, light and shadow. And it's much more dramatic, you know, than color.
Yeah. I know that your father was greatly disappointed in how The Magnificent Ambersons turned out, but I think it's a beautiful picture to watch.
Well, fortunately, they couldn't completely ruin it, so we still have a lot of his original footage in there. But I think he was terribly upset because they took it away from him, and they changed the ending, and they hacked it to pieces, and it's not at all the film that he originally intended, and I can imagine how upsetting that is when you see somebody just takes your work away from you and basically butchers it.
Mm. Were there other great disappointments in his career?
Well, I think just about every movie that he made in Hollywood was taken out of his hands, except Citizen Kane. With Citizen Kane, he had total artistic control, which may be why it's considered one of the greatest movies ever made, if not the greatest. But with every film after that, starting with Magnificent Ambersons, the studio took it away from him and made significant changes. And I think that was very disappointing for him.
Mm.
It's one of the reasons he went to Europe, where he hoped that he would be able to function more creatively as an independent filmmaker.
Yeah. I hadn't realized that Citizen Kane didn't do well at the box office when it was first released. Is that why he lost control?
Well, I think you're right. Citizen Kane was a total flop at the box office. It was largely due to William Randolph Hearst, who tried to suppress it, who refused to have the movie shown in the theaters that he controlled, who worked very hard trying to destroy the negative of Citizen Kane. But didn't succeed in that, fortunately. But certainly he did everything he could to damage my father's reputation. And because Citizen Kane wasn't a box office success, this is one of the reasons why the studio took The Magnificent Ambersons away from my father. They didn't want, you know, they were only interested in making money, and they didn't want more and more movies flopping at the box office, no matter how brilliant they might be. And again, I think the public simply wasn't ready for the kind of movies that my father had to make.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. If he had been born in Italy or in France or in Sweden, where there's a tradition of art film, then he might have had a totally different career. But because he had to make films in Hollywood, that was the place to make movies, and they really didn't understand what he was doing. He was almost doomed before he began.
When was the last time there was a retrospective of his work in the United States?
He's never had a full
really?
Retrospective. He's never had a full retrospective of his work. He had a partial retrospective of his work in both simultaneously in New York and in Los Angeles in 2004. The director of the Munich Film Museum, Stefan Drossler, who is now all of the... I should back up a little bit. When my father died, his will left all his unfinished works to his companion, Oya Kodar. She had been his companion for the last 20 years of his life, and she had worked side by side with him, and he wanted her to have his unfinished and incomplete works. And then Oya tried very, very hard for a number of years. She tried to get financial backing to complete some of these things, but wasn't successful. And so eventually she decided that she wanted to deposit all this film in a safe place, and she chose the Film Museum in Munich. And the director there, Stefan Drossler, became the curator of the Orson Welles archive there. Now, Oya gave all this material to the Munich Film Museum with the proviso that every 2 to 3 years it should be shown in an educational venue so that people could see the work. You know, she didn't want it just sitting in a vault.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted people to actually see it, even if we're seeing rushes or partially completed films. It should still be shown. And so Stefan... He had a retrospective at the Film Forum here in New York, which is when I first met him, and also in Los Angeles, and at which he showed many of these things, which are fascinating. But the biggest retrospective that's ever been held of Orson Welles' work was not in his native land, unfortunately, but in Locarno, Switzerland. In 2005, there's an international film festival every year in Locarno, and in 2005 they did a special homage to my father, and they showed, it went on for something like 15 days, every day they showed his films, documentaries about him, his work in television, his work in the theater, his work in radio. It was just absolutely fascinating, and people from all over Europe came to see this.
It should happen here.
It definitely should happen here, and I do hope in my lifetime that it does happen here.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Oya Kodar. She appears to have been your father's, ultimately his soulmate.
Absolutely. She was his soulmate. A perfect choice of words.
And
a lovely, lovely person.
What a nice way to end the books, more or less, is you're meeting her.
I think it's meant a lot to Oya and me to meet each other, and to we now feel that we're like sisters, and it's meant a lot to us both, because she's still grieving for my father, even though he's been dead since 1985, and yet she still misses him.
Hmm. We're running down on time. I need to ask you some more questions about your sisters, I think, is what I'd like to ask you about. Rebecca's
yes, my
mother.
Dear sister, Rebecca.
Yeah.
That's Rita Hayworth's child by my father, and she died tragically in 2004. She had a very aggressive cancer, which carried her off very quickly. And Becky and I were close. I had known her as a little baby, and we kept up with each other and were in constant communication. But my other half-sister, Beatrice, I really don't know her at all. She's the child of my father's third wife, Paola Mori. And the first time I saw Beatrice was in Hong Kong when she was 3 years old, when I had gone to see my father and meet his wife, Paola. And then the next time I saw Beatrice was at my father's funeral when Beatrice was in her early 30s. So I think that illustrates the nature of our non-relationship, you know.
Well,
that I really had almost no contact with her at all.
Yeah. Well, the years are, you know, significant, and the geographic distance is significant as well.
Absolutely, because we grew up with different mothers and in different parts of the world, and really we're only sisters by blood, but not in any other sense.
Yeah. Another thing that happens in this book of yours, In My Father's Shadow, is we get another picture of Rita Hayworth. What a wonderful person, and yet so, her life was so full of so much heartbreak.
Yes, she had a tragic life, and yet she was the sweetest person. She was sweet and simple and trusting, and I'm afraid most of the men in her life took, with the exception of my father, took terrible advantage of her. And my sister Becky, she inherited that same sweet, loving nature that her mother had.
Hmm. Rita Hayworth comes across. There's a wonderful photograph in the book of you and your father and Rita Hayworth poolside at her home. She seems to have been, and I mean this in the best sense of the world, word, childlike.
She was childlike. She was totally lacking in pretension. She never bothered with makeup. She always went around in very casual clothes, as you can see in that photograph. And that's it. She was just herself, you know. It was hard to reconcile the Rita that you met in real life with the glamorous love goddess that you saw on the screen. And she herself made this famous remark, you know, men go to bed with Gilda, Gilda being her perhaps most famous movie role. She said, men go to bed with Gilda, but they wake up with me.
Oh.
There's something sad in that, too.
It is. There is.
Yeah.
There is.
But it's hard to be a love goddess, you know, because I think it does raise expectations which can't be met in the real world.
That's a 24/7 expectation.
Yes, that's right.
I think one of the things that is troubling about your father is he had this pattern of being unfaithful to his wives, and also for being absent for long stretches with you. And I don't know about Becky and Beatrice.
Well, it was the same.
Yeah.
It was the same with all his children, because he was a man who poured everything into his creative work. And I think he simply didn't have time. He didn't have time to be a father or to be a husband or even to be a friend. He just lived for the making of art. And that's something you had to understand and accept about him, that he couldn't be. He was marvelous company. He was inspiring to be with, but you couldn't expect him to behave you couldn't expect of him what you would expect of a father.
Mm.
That was very hard for me to deal with as a child, because, you know, a child wants a father, and I was being constantly told, oh, you know, your father's a genius. You can't expect him to be a father, but that's exactly what I did expect. So I had a lot of trouble with that growing up.
Yeah.
But then I came to see that, although it's true that he wasn't really a father to me in any way that mattered to me, at the same time, he gave me things that I could never have gotten from an ordinary father. So I came to see that in the long run, I still did get, I got quite a lot out of being his daughter. And today I can say that I'm very proud to be the daughter of Orson Welles.
Yeah. When you had him, you had him. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the times that I spent with him were unforgettable. And he was very supportive of me in many ways that mattered to me. I mean,
He encouraged you.
He encouraged me, and he also set a very good example for me. Because what a lot of people don't know about my father is that he was a man of high principle, and he fought for the causes that he believed in. And he was, in his own way, a very ethical man. He may not have been responsible in his personal relationships, but he was ethical in the ways that truly matter.
Yeah, I would say in that respect he was a man of conscience. What makes you most proud of him in that respect?
Well, I tell this story in my book about how he came to the defense of an African-American soldier who had been honorably discharged in World War II, returned to the South, which was still segregated at that time, and on taking the bus home, got off the bus and used a restroom, which was not realizing it was for whites only, and was so brutally beaten by the local sheriff that he was actually blinded. When my father heard the story, at the time he was a big radio star and he had his own radio program, he was so horrified that he began issuing weekly appeals on his radio program to bring the sheriff to justice. I think it was CBS, they came to him and they said, Orson, if you keep this up, you know, we don't want to keep hearing about this black soldier having been blinded. If you keep this up, we're going to kill your show and take you off the air. Well, my father felt that it was more important to bring the sheriff to justice than it was to keep his show, so he just kept on. They did take the show away from him, but they also did finally capture the sheriff, identify him, and bring him to trial. And I always was very proud of my father for this because, to me, this illustrated that he put his principles ahead of his own popularity as a radio star.
Hmm. Chris Fader, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon and sharing your story in this book, In My Father's Shadow.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. I've enjoyed it.
Chris Wells Fader is the author of In My Father's Shadow, A Daughter Remembers Orson Welles. The publisher is Algonquin Books.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to Illinois Public Media. It is a Friday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason, and now with a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade futures markets. Nearby March wheat futures down 7 cents today with a high price of $4.93¾ in Chicago. The high at the low at 4.80¼ with a settlement price there at 4.86½ down 7. May contract at 5.08¾ high, low at 4.95. Settlement price at $5.25¼ down 7¼. And the July futures, 5.20¾, the high, the low at 5.07¾, settlement price at 5.14, down 7¼. September contract, 5.35, the high, the low at 24¼, settlement price at $5.29½, down 7½. And December wheat futures, 5.61¼, the high, the low at 5.50¼, settlement price 5.54½, down 7¼ in Chicago for the December contract. Nearby May futures down 7 today in the hard red. They finished at 5.05¾, the March at 4.94½, down 6¾ from Kansas City. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, losses today, but not by much, down about a penny to 2 cents. Nearby March contract with a high price today at 3.64¼ and a low at 3.57½, managed to settle a penny and 3/4 lower at 3.61½ for the March corn. May futures, 3.75¾ the high. The low there at $3.69. Settlement price at 3.73¼, down a penny and 3/4. And July contract, 3.86¼ the high. The low at 3.80. Settled 3.84¼, a penny and a half lower. September futures in the corn pit, 3.93 the high. The low at 3.87½. Settled at 2.91¼, down a penny and a quarter. And December contract, 3.99¼ for the high, the low at 94. Settlement price at $3.97¼, down 1¼ for the harvest month in the corn pit. The March contract of 2011 had a high price today at $4.10, a low at 4.05¾, settled at 4.08¼, down 1¼. March oat futures a half cent higher on the afternoon to settle at 2.32¾. The May contract at 2.41¾ in the oats, up 0.75¢. Now the soy complex, nearby soybean futures up 2 cents, 9.48 the high, the low at 26, settlement price at 9.45 up 2. May futures 9.57 on the high, the low at 9.35¼. Settlement price at 9.54 up 2, and July futures 9.61¾ the high, the low at 42. Settlement price at $9.60¾ up 2 cents. August contract 9.57 the high, the low at 39¾. Settlement price at $9.56 up a penny and 3/4 in September, 9.38 the high, the low at 24. Settlement price at $9.37½. Up 1¼ cents. The November contract, this is where the losses start in the bean pit, just a half cent lower, 9.23¾ the high, the low at 9.10. Settlement price down a half at 9.22. The January at 9.31½, the March at 9.39½, and the May at 9.43. For next year, all down a half cent in the bean pit. March bean meal futures today, 280.30 the high, the low at 273. Settlement price at 280, up $2.60. May bean meal, 274.70 the high, the low at 267.10. Settlement price at 274.20. Up $3.20. March bean oil futures 38.15, the high, the low at 37.51. Settlement price at 37.84, down 30 cents in the May contract. 38.63, the high, the low at 37.98. Settlement price in the May bean oil futures 38.32, and they finished up 31 on the afternoon. In a moment, the numbers from the livestock side of the CME Group.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Now here are the numbers as they settled in Chicago for the livestock contracts. Nearby February live cattle futures today at $89.60 top, bottom at $89.15. Settlement price at $89.37½, up 2½ cents, or rather down 2½ cents today. April futures $91.67½ the high, the low at $90.70. April live cattle $90.77½, 77½ higher. And the June futures $89.25 the high. The low there at $88.50, settled to $88.55, down 57½. August contract $88.17½ the high, the low at $87.65. Settlement price at $87.72½, down 42½. Feeder cattle, March contract, $100.87½ top, bottom at $99.72½, settled $99.75, down 75 cents. April futures down 70 cents, a 102 top, bottom at $100.80, settlement price at $100.82½. May futures, 102.90 the high, the low at 101.70. Settled 101.87½, down 65. And the August feeder cattle, $104 the high, the low at 103 and a nickel. Settlement price at 103.27½, down 50 cents for the day. February lean hog futures now 67.62½ the high, the low at 67.30. Settlement price at 67.45, down 17½. The April futures 68.55 the high, the low at 67.55. Settlement price at $68.20, up 52½ cents on the day. May futures a 75.10 top, bottom at 74.10. Settlement price at $74.95, 55 cents higher. And the June contract, $78.10 the high, the low at $76.95. And the June live hog settled at $78.05, up 77½ cents. Pork bellies, the March contract down a dollar, 86.80 the top, the bottom at $84. And a settlement price on that bottom at $84. Once again, the frozen pork bellies finished the March contract down a dollar on the afternoon. You're coming up on the top of the hour, 2 o'clock Central Time, listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3.